also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz.
The headlines. Press TV denounces the U.S. for seizing its website and other Iranian and regional news networks, calling it a terrorist attack on global public opinion. Security sources in Iran say the country has foiled a sabotage attempt on one of the buildings of its Atomic Energy Organization. And Russia says that a British Navy destroyer trespassed into its waters in the Black Sea, forcing a Russian patrol ship to fire warning shots at the vessel. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Press TV has strongly condemned the U.S. government's seizure of its website, calling the move a violation of international law. In a statement, Press TV also called the U.S. action a terrorist attack on the world's public opinion, adding that the decision was an example of the media dictatorship. Tehran-based International News Network announced that the viewers can now access its website through .ir domain. Earlier, the U.S. government confiscated 36 websites belonging to Iranian and regional news outlets, including Press TV. Viewers trying to access these websites see a message showing the domains are seized by the U.S. government. It also cites U.S. sanctions law for the seizure. The websites of Iran's Al Alam and Yemen's Al Masira TV channels are among the outlets targeted. Hossein Abughaiti is an activist and political commentator who joins us. Hossein Abughaiti, one of the websites is actually one that's related to Yemen in this case. What reasons do you see for the U.S. to have done this?
This action it shows that the United States control of the internet. It's actually using it to help or to interfere in the policies of foreign policies of many countries. And this shows that if you don't agree with the United States, or if you show if you are against international policies inside Yemen or in other area, that's why we have seen that they have actually seized those websites. It's a type of web piracies. So the United States, we see now in latest decision against Ansarullah in Yemen, they have actually put them in terrorist group. They have used the blockade in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis and disaster that's actually caused by the United States support to Saudi Arabia. They have are using this as a weapons, and now they are using the internet as a weapons. And there is as well another case of internet piracy is conducted by Facebook and as well by Twitter. They are blocking many people who are actually exposing Saudi intervention and U.S. intervention in Yemen. Anyone who reports the crimes that's done against Yemenis, we see that their account, either in Facebook or Twitter, are seized. But here in Sana'a, they actually have expected this. It will happen, and just imagine it has happened during Biden, the term as U.S. president. Biden has promised that he wants to end the war in Yemen. He wants to stop the humanitarian disaster that's happening in Yemen. But on the other hand, we've seen that he is actually blocking and attacking and targeting websites who actually expose the Saudi crimes in Yemen. They are targeting countries or anyone who is actually in support of the Yemeni case. And this, as they say in Sana'a, it exposed as well the United States and United States rule in Yemen. And United States, they are not actually in favor of freedom of speech. We've seen that the United States, as an example, they are using the Human Rights Council at the UN or the Human Rights Watch, and they are condemning many countries as they claim, like Iran or China or other countries, for humanitarian abuse. And those all not fact, and they are based on lies. But we see it on the other hand, when, as example, the international court in Netherlands, when they have the United States has enforced sanctions on some of the judge there because they tried to bring cases against U.S. crime in Afghanistan and Iraq and other countries, and actually the war on Yemen, the terrorist war in Syria, and as well this pressure and new sanction that has conducted against Iran and the cancelling of the nuclear deal. It shows that those countries actually are against the U.S. Policy, the U.S. piracy, and here in Sana'a, they took this step as one more reason to continue their fight against U.S. intervention in Yemen or against U.S. intervention in any other country. And I just want to add that they have targeted those websites, and they have targeted many websites in Iran and in other countries.
Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That's Hossein El-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator. Thank you. Iran's foreign ministry has called the U.S. seizure of several websites of Iranian and other regional news outlets an example of systematic effort to distort the freedom of speech on a global level. In a statement, ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the move is an attempt to silence independent voices, describing it, quote, Washington's shameful double standard. Khatibzadeh said the move also shows the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is continuing the path of his predecessor. He vowed that Iran would pursue the issue through legal channels. Separately, Iran's Minister of Information and Communications Technology slammed the U.S. for confiscating the domains of several Iranian and West Asian news websites.
The move shows that the resistance front enjoys wide-spanning influence because the U.S. government has breached the values it claims to be upholding. The U.S. action is not the first of its kind. During the past 3 or 4 years, many measures have been taken to hinder Iran's speedy progress in the virtual space, from removing Iranian apps in violation of international laws to imposing sanctions on Iranian firms to prevent them from accessing software distribution platforms.
Well, Zahid Jahami noted that Washington's move shows its desperation in the face of resistance. Earlier, President Hassan Rouhani's chief of staff said Washington's measure was against freedom of speech. Mahmoud Ghazi added that the U.S. blocked the sites to prevent the reflection of different viewpoints online. Ghazi said that Iran will use all legal and international means to follow up the case. He also denounced Washington's move as unconstructive for the ongoing talks on the revival of the Iran nuclear deal. Security sources in Iran say the country has foiled a sabotage attempt on one of the buildings of its atomic energy organization. Sources said the attempt took place in the early hours of Wednesday. They said the attempt was foiled before causing any casualties or damage. No further details are available for now. The same sources said an investigation has been launched into the incident. The German foreign minister says that he sees a good chance of concluding talks on the revival of the Iran nuclear deal soon, despite major issues remain to be resolved between the negotiating parties.
Was die Verhandlungen in Wien angeht,
as far as the negotiations in Vienna are concerned, they are not easy. That has become clear in recent weeks. There are many technical questions that need to be clarified. Nevertheless, every round of negotiations moves forward step by step, and we assume that in the new environment after the presidential election, there are good opportunities to conclude these negotiations in the foreseeable future.
Heiko Maas was referring to Iran's presidential vote last week, which saw principalist candidate Ebrahim Raisi winning with a landslide. He was speaking in a joint press conference with his U.S. counterpart, Antony Blinken. Hours earlier, a senior Iranian official said that Tehran and Washington have agreed to remove all sanctions on Iran's oil, insurance, and shipping. Chief of Staff of the Iranian government, Mahmoud Ghazi, said that over 1,000 sanctions imposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump are to be removed under the current agreement. Tehran has time and again said that it will return to compliance to the 2015 deal once the U.S. removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Iran's President-elect Ebrahim Raisi spoke with reporters following his win in last week's election. To question that whether he is willing to meet with the U.S. President Joe Biden, Raisi said no. The President-elect also spoke about his views on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, as well as the country's regional policies. And one thing was certain, his foreign policy agenda would neither start nor end with the nuclear agreement.
Iran's President-elect Said Ebrahim Raisi has held his first press briefing in the capital, Tehran. The event, attended by representatives of domestic and foreign media outlets, was Raisi's first briefing following his election as Iran's next president. During the media conference, Raisi touched on a number of issues, including the fate of the landmark nuclear deal with Iran, officially known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Raisi said the U.S. must return to full compliance with the 2015 deal. We tell the United States that you have to remove all sanctions imposed on Iran and must return to the nuclear deal and fulfill your obligations. Europeans must not be influenced by the U.S. pressure and must act upon their commitments. This is what the Iranian nation wants from you.
Iran President-elect Ebrahim Raisi said that the U.S. and Europe need to fulfill their commitments under the JCPOA, meaning that he sees this as a two-sided way and not one-sided. And this is something provisional, and he says that Iran will comply with the terms of the nuclear deal, provided that the other sides and parties do the same.
Raisi said the main focus of his administration's foreign policy will be to make sure about complete removal of unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. after Washington's illegal withdrawal from the nuclear deal with Tehran, followed by verification of sanctions removal. He also said Europeans must not be influenced by the U.S. pressure and must act upon their commitments. Raisi further ruled out the idea of meeting the U.S. President Joe Biden, saying the foreign policy of his administration will not start from the JCPOA, nor will it be restricted to the JCPOA.
One of the options he will be trying to seek during his term, I think, will be to follow a, let's say, trade-based foreign policy and approach. There is a potential and capacity to cooperate with neighboring countries or regional countries and eastern countries. So he will have this option as a tool in his foreign policy toolbox. And let's say, this policy, he will try to prove the Americans and Europeans that if they think that Iran cannot survive without the nuclear deal, they are wrong.
During his election campaign, Raisi explained about some of the policies that his future administration would adopt. They included foreign policy issues. Raisi spoke about an active diplomacy and said that his administration would interact with the world, but he stressed it is illogical that the country's progress, including its economic development, is tied to foreign relations.
Asked about a proposal by U.S. President Joe Biden to sign a new deal with Iran to address the country's missile program and regional influence as well, Raisi said issues related to Iran's regional influence and missile program are not open to negotiation.
Iran's regional and missile programs are not negotiable. They have not fulfilled their commitments regarding issues that have already been negotiated and agreed upon. How can they enter into new discussions?
Raisi said the U.S. failed to observe its obligations under the nuclear deal, stressing that Washington is in no position to call on Iran for further negotiations on Iran's missile program and its regional influence. Raisi further stressed that he intends to develop constructive and balanced relations with all countries, particularly Iran's neighbors.
We have seen that Iran, as a result of U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal, as well as maximum pressure by the United States, moved toward more cooperation with other countries, including China, Russia, and its neighboring countries. This can be somehow more visible during a new conservative president in Tehran, meaning Ebrahim Raisi. If he takes office, I think, and if the Europeans and Americans do not fulfill their commitments under the nuclear deal, he will be moving toward more cooperation with non-Western countries.
Asked about the future outlook for Iran's relations with Saudi Arabia, Raisi said, from the viewpoint of Iran, there is no obstacle to the reopening of Iran's and Saudi Arabia's embassies. Raisi also touched on the issue of Saudi-led war in Yemen, saying that Iran stresses that the war against Yemen must come to a rapid halt and that Yemen must be run by Yemenis. He also said that Iran will continue to be a defender of the oppressed people, including the Palestinians, stressing that from the perspective of Iran, Palestinians are the owners of Palestine. Raisi suggested that a referendum is the best solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
The Israeli regime continues its demolition drive in the occupied West Bank despite condemnations from Palestinians and the international community. Israeli bulldozers backed by forces razed to the ground two more homes in Al-Isawiyah town, east of occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. Earlier in the day, Palestinian media reported the destruction of buildings near the outpost of Benjamin. Last week, Israeli forces also leveled a house in the town of Beit Umar. The demolitions are the latest in Israel's long-running campaign to flatten Palestinian homes and property. The structures are usually destroyed under the pretext of lacking construction permits. But Palestinians say that the demolitions are part of efforts by Israel to expand its illegal settlements in the occupied territories. The Russian Defense Ministry says one of its border patrol ships fired warning shots at a British Navy destroyer after it deviated from its path in the Black Sea. The ministry said the patrol ship fired shots at an aircraft dropped four bombs after Britain's HMS Defender ventured through Russian territorial waters. It added that the Russian Navy had issued a preliminary warning that weapons would be used in case the passing ship violated Russian borders. Russia's foreign ministry spokesperson, Maria Zakharova, said the incident was a blatant provocation by the UK. The incident took place off the coast of Crimea. The UK Ministry of Defense has, however, denied Moscow's claim that warning shots were fired. Rather claims the Royal Navy ship was passing through Ukrainian waters in accordance with international law. In Europe, serious concerns have been raised about the Delta variant of the coronavirus that might halt the country's progress in cutting down new cases and deaths. The European Union's Disease Control Agency says the Delta variant could account for 90% of new COVID cases in the bloc in the coming months. It stressed that a new strain, which first emerged in India, is more transmissible than other variants. Meanwhile, in Britain, the number of daily cases and deaths is rising again after a substantial decline since the start of the year. The variant makes up more than 6% of the new cases in the country. Other European countries, including Portugal, Germany, France, and Spain, are also struggling with the new strain. The situation has led the governments to suspend or delay the lifting of restrictions. The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea, who visited South Korea, says he would meet with North Korean representatives anytime, anywhere, and without preconditions. North Korea has ridiculed the U.S. overture, saying that it would lead to nowhere but disappointment. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang. U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
the limelight.
The problem of U.S. police brutality and violence and the links to white supremacism is hundreds of years old. One officer like Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer who knelt on the neck of George Floyd, leading to Floyd's death, facing a jail term, will not change the entire system. We now present you an article written by Richard Sedan, a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, Chauvin is Guilty, but the system is bigger than Chauvin and it must change. News that Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer who knelt on the neck of George Floyd, leading to Floyd's death, had been found guilty on all charges, has been welcomed by millions of people. But it is vital at this stage to remember that justice in one case will not repair a broken system, which in many people's view is working as it was designed and intended to. There is a mode of thinking which persists and which suggests that the problem of unchecked police brutality and violence in the United States can be thought of in terms of a few bad apples, and therefore that dealing with rotten individuals within the police force will fix things. While individuals who commit murder while wearing police uniform must be held accountable, the idea that they are the exception rather than the rule is simply not true. According to the FBI, the institutional corruption and the infiltration of law enforcement from those with white supremacist ideologies is a deep-seated and long-standing problem in the United States. The FBI staff have themselves published several reports on this matter. For those who understand the history of the United States, the scale and depth of the issue is simply the modern chapter of the continued legalized brutality against black communities, beginning since the days of slavery and the inception of the country. The police, of course, have their literal roots in slave-catching gangs. That history has never been accounted for, and the legacy of it continues to this day with deadly consequences. The entire U.S. criminal justice system is riddled with people belonging to white supremacist organizations. We hear about the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, but the reality is that there are countless groups which have those leanings and affiliations. Many believe that part of the reason the United States refuses to designate the Proud Boys as a terrorist group, despite their involvement in the 6th of January Washington riots, which was described as an act of domestic terrorism by the FBI, is because too many current serving police officers would be implicated. The problem of police brutality and violence and the links to white supremacism is hundreds of years old. One police officer like Derek Chauvin facing a jail term will not change the entire system, but it might be purportedly a step in the right direction. Each and every police officer guilty of the kind of violence we saw from Derek Chauvin must face the full force of the law, which of course they themselves are supposed to uphold. If Derek Chauvin is given the sentence he deserves, his case must set a precedent, move forward and deter other police officers from behaving like him. Police officers must be punished for racist killings and murdering with impunity. If they know they face the prospect of jail and will also lose their pensions, they will be deterred from carrying out such acts. It's a question of power and money. The days of police officers knowing that they automatically have the benefit of the doubt, no matter what their behavior, must come to an end. The energy and momentum and public outcry over the case of Derek Chauvin must now be directed towards all cases of police violence and injustice with lethal consequences. Recently, much was made of George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which many hope will become law. But what is not being talked about so much is the fact that this measure would actually allocate the police hundreds of millions more dollars, in theory, to ensure that they improve policing methods and to bolster their budgets in this regard. But if the police are given more money while being entrusted to police themselves, the move could spell potential disaster. New legislation might come into fruition, but if rules already exist which the police are meant to follow, but they do not follow, what difference will it make? Again, to reiterate, the overarching problem is an issue of the abuse of power, which needs to be punished, because police officers are already breaking the law when they unjustly kill with impunity. But rarely are they charged, and tragically, we have already seen a sobering reminder of the grim reality of things on the very day that Derek Chauvin was found guilty. Approximately half an hour before the verdict of Derek Chauvin was announced, news broke that a 16-year-old teenage black girl named Makia Bryant had been shot dead by a white police officer in Columbus, Ohio. Police say Makia Bryant was carrying a knife when they arrived at the scene, which others say had actually been dropped just moments before she was shot. Makia Bryant was believed to have been carrying the knife due to her involvement in a fight in which she was defending herself and is said to have called the police herself. Critics are arguing that whatever had taken place, the police officers firing several shots killing Bryant was excessive and reflective of a trigger-happy stance which police automatically have towards black people compared to white people, and certainly not how they should have handled this situation. Many are commenting that there was no attempt by the police to de-escalate the situation and that lethal force should have been a last resort. Tragically, it seems it wasn't. The facts of this case are still being established, but if what we are hearing about this case is true, it serves as yet another reminder amid the backdrop of the Derek Chauvin case of just how much work is yet to be done to change the state of affairs regarding violent policing in the United States. African Americans are not safe in the United States with the police operating as they currently do. There are countless cases of black people actually calling the police for help, who then end up dead as a result. Until we see a consistent trend developing of police officers continually being charged and jailed, sending a clear and strong enough message to force a change in the culture of policing, the problem will persist. And where there might seem to be a veneer of change, where in fact there is none, things could even get worse.
Join us in this journey.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Inside Israel. Anti-Semitism has been widely used to slander all those who do not agree with Israel in whatever the case might be. But now, Israeli officials are being accused of anti-Semitism. New videos have been recently released by Israeli officials that actually mocks other Israelis and Jews in ways that can only be explained as anti-Semitic. The term has gained widespread popularity on an international level, mainly due to wide use, or some now say abuse, of the word by Israeli officials themselves to justify pretty much everything they do, from internal policy to external policy. But for Israeli officials, the term doesn't come any more handy than when others are criticizing them. When Israel is criticized, it automatically uses the anti-Semitic card to slander others. But what happens if the table is turned? We've all heard of Israeli officials and the regime in general call anyone that points to their crimes against humanity, war crimes, and their dysfunctional system as anti-Semitic. But activists from the non-for-profit U.S.-based Electronic Intifada online newspaper have found that the Israeli regime, in its nature, is actually anti-Semitic. According to the Electronic Intifada, Israel's new ambassador to the U.K. stereotyped a Jewish human rights group in anti-Semitic terms in a video she released as part of a campaign for a political party. In a Hebrew YouTube video, Israeli ambassador Zipi Hotaveli mocked breaking the silence as being motivated by money. The video depicts Jews as greedy. According to Jews Worldwide, and of course Israel, depictions of Jews as being greedy is a major theme in the history of anti-Semitic stereotypes. Breaking the Silence, by the way, is an Israeli NGO established in 2004 by veterans of the Israel military and aims to shed light on the cruelty of the Israeli occupation in occupied Palestinian territories. The video also targets Israeli human rights groups B'Tselem, calling them extreme left, and accuses them of receiving funding from the European Union and being agents of the EU. The video calls on the extreme right to attack these organizations so that their funding will cease to exist.
Anti-Semitism is basically a system that is designed to suppress all forms of criticism of Israel, Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish politics, or should I say, everything Jewish. Whether there is really hatred
about Jews for being Jews in the world, I actually hardly believe it. I think that a lot of people oppose Israel, and for a good reason, and it should be legitimate. A lot of people oppose some aspects of Jewish culture, aspect of Judaism, definitely aspect of Jewish politics, and all of that should be totally legitimized. As long as we don't hate people for being a people, I think that all criticism should be considered legitimate. I think that it is way more than Israel. The answer is obviously yes, but it's not just Israel. This is something that we see throughout the entire spectrum of Jewish politics, and it's not just Jewish politics. We can see that all over the world, politicians are weaponizing anti-Semitism in order to serve their own interests. We saw it in Britain in the case of Jeremy Corbyn. We saw it in the American election. Both sides accuse the other of anti-Semitism. And it's pretty, meaningless, because really you cannot find a single voice in the political arena, in the arts, in academia, who criticizes Jews for being Jews. Again, people criticize Jews legitimately for politics, for culture, for Israeli politics. You have to remind you that Israel calls itself the Jewish state and claims to represent world Jews. Whether it is true or not is another question.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Guy Blue says, well, anti-Israel doesn't necessarily mean anti-Semitic. Anak sarcastically says, people are calling Beteslim anti-Semitic. At this point, anyone who criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic, even Israelis. CEO of Corn says, but it does feel a little strange that it can be considered anti-Semitic to criticize Israel, not Jews, but the Zionist portion of the regime, for genuine humanitarian crimes, or labeling American anti-Semitic fascist Nazis being considered insensitive.
Shameful what Israel has done and the supporters of Israel have done in terms of false accusations of anti-Semitism. I say that it's dangerous because anti-Semitism is something that is very real, and it usually occurs in modern times within the context of a rise in Islamophobia, a rise in anti-Black hatred, a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment. So it's usually part of a larger rise of fascism in these modern times. And Israel has used accusations of anti-Semitism in order to protect themselves from criticism for their system of apartheid and their human rights abuses towards Palestinians. This takes place both from the state of Israel and from supporters of Israel, including pro-Israel lobby groups in the U.S. And what it does is it really confuses people as to what anti-Semitism is and as to the real dangers of say that the use of anti-Semitism has backfired against Jews around the world and against so many people who experience racism and xenophobia by falsely conflating anti-Semitism very real danger with criticism, legitimate criticism of Israel's human rights abuses, we dilute the impact of calling out and combating anti-Semitism. And so defense of Israel by Israel as a state and by pro-Israel groups and individuals continues to create a real danger for Jews around the world and for our allies who are we are working together with to secure safety for all people.
ZP Hotavelli is the same person who back in 2019, during the British elections, accused then-Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn of anti-Semitism, calling him troubling and a real danger to Israel. This shows the double standards of Israel's principles and practice of hard-right Jewish ethno-nationalism are now simply the new normal in Israeli politics, according to the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, Anthony Lerman. For Israel and many of its officials, the only definition of anti-Semitism that matters is failure to support Israel. This isn't the first instance of Israeli officials and anti-Semitism. In 2017, Israeli-American multimillionaire and key Israel lobby donor Adam Milstein depicted liberal Jewish billionaire George Soros as an octopus with tentacles spanning the globe, practically identical to Nazi propaganda. In 2015, a regime-funded body representing Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank released a video which depicted a Jewish-European conspiracy to fabricate war crimes against Israel. Many see Israel's actions as part of a growing trend to equate criticism of Israeli regime policies with anti-Semitism. Scholars from all over the world have noted that it is increasingly difficult to have a proper discussion about Zionism or a normal critical debate about Israel. Earlier this year, in Germany, a renowned scholar, Achille Mbembe, who is currently teaching at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, was accused of racism and anti-Semitism by public figures and institutions because of his support of the BDS movement. BDS, that is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, is a Palestinian-led global movement for the freedom, justice, and equality of Palestinians. His case is just one of many.
Yes, completely legal and ethical. The state of Israel doesn't let to do these critics, but ethically it's completely good to say you are doing something wrong. You have to change this policy, as same as you can say to other states. There, the states, the countries in the world, they can make errors, or they can do things that are very bad against humans, against human rights, and you have to, if you are a journalist or a political scientist or a professor, you have to say the truth, so maybe they change their ways of behavior. Yes, they are criticizing everyone that it's not from a right-wing ideology. And this right-wing is similar to fascism and Nazism. They are saying, for example, to liberal Jews or to socialist Jews that they are anti-Semites. The Nazi regime in Germany of Hitler accused the Jews to be or capitalist exploiters or communist propagandists. So the Israel regime now is trying to do the same thing to Jews that they are liberal. They accuse that they are capitalist and they sell by money and greed and all these things. And if they are socialist, they say that they are communist, like it used to be the Soviet Union. That is the case of a liberal Jew named George Soros. He's an Hungarian from Hungary, liberal Jew that is criticized to be an anti-Semite because he's a liberal Jew and the Hungary government is a friend with the Zionist state now, and they both are ultra-right wings, and they are really the bad guys, and they are making guilty liberals or socialists.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. King Benjamin says, if you're against funding for Israel, you're anti-Semitic. Kevin says, but of course, it's easier to cry anti-Semitism and try to slur Beit Haslam through guilt by association than address its substantive criticism, because the report's analysis and conclusions are careful, sober, and convincing. Jesse says, yes, it is totally absurd. Israel is an awful apartheid entity. 100% agree about the irony in it all. I always say it's not anti-Semitic to be anti-Israel.
Well, of course, we get into the complexity of the overlap between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Zionism is a term, an ideological term that emerges from the late 1800s. Theodor Herzl began a process where there was a lobbying, an effort to create a Jewish state in the Middle East. That is what Zionism is. And Zionism, of course, there's a range of Zionist interpretations and manifestations of that ideology, going from labor Zionism to revisionist Zionism on the right wing. There are many Jewish people from the beginning of Zionism who were hostile towards Zionism, who thought that it was wrong to associate their religion with a political movement. And there are still many Jews, especially Orthodox Jews and rabbis in Israel, who think it's wrong to use the Jewish religion as a basis for the creation of a Jewish state. So there are secular critics of Zionism as well, Jewish voices for peace in the United States, independent Jewish voices here in Canada. And these are Jewish people who are critical of Zionism and are critical of the treatment by the Israeli government, especially of Palestinian Arabs, and the torture and maltreatment and failure to recognize and indeed the tendency to crush the human rights of Palestinian people. And those Jewish critics very much resent being called anti-Semitic because they're Jewish, but of course oftentimes the term self-hating Jews comes up, and this group can be condemned as self-hating Jews, so it's complex. Well, it may have been overused, but the power of the Israel lobby is such that there really isn't a lot of debate, say within the United States, say within Canada, say within Great Britain, about how the Israeli state abuses this term, anti-Semitism. It's kind of a dangerous ground to even criticize the Jewish state for abusing the term anti-Semitism. So this is a phenomena that sees, although it might be overused, there isn't a lot of tolerance for any real discussion of these issues. I look to my Canadian Parliament and I don't see the possibility of much discussion because all political parties are of a similar mind when it comes to Israel. They identify and support Israel in large measure. So this abuse of the term anti-Semitism, it comes out particularly in the way that the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism is being adopted by many governments, by many municipalities, by many universities, by many labor unions. All kinds of agencies adopt this definition, which basically says that to criticize Israel is to be anti-Semitic, that any criticism of Israel can be interpreted as anti-Semitic. There should be much more debate on this, but the context seems to not be there. Well, anti-Semitism is a very ironic phrase. You could say that Semites don't include Ashkenazi Jews, for instance. I mean, Jewish people are genetically diverse. They have many backgrounds. They're not, at the moment, Jewish people. It's not a particularly missionary religion, but it has been in the past a missionary religion, and Ashkenazi Jews derived from people who were converts to Judaism. And so, ironically, Ashkenazi Jews tend to have an elite role within Israel, an elite role within the Jewish community collectively, and this group of people who are not Semites use their power against people who are Semites, including the Palestinians and other Arabs. So that's a great irony of the term.
It seems that the burden that Israel has imposed on all those who are criticizing it has backfired. Israel seems to use anti-Semitic as a weapon, but that weapon has backfired as it has been overused and exhausted. And now Israel's adversaries, who are Jewish and Israeli, are becoming victims of Israel's anti-Semitic slander. This same slander of other people who do not agree with Israel has exposed Israel for what many believe is anti-Semitic in nature. Ultra-Orthodox Jews accuse the ruling white European Jewish secular class in Israel as stealing their identity and their name. According to ultra-Orthodox Jews, elite European secular Zionist white Jews at the turn of the 19th century absorbed the attitudes of anti-Semites in Europe and looked at the real Jews themselves with the same disgust and loathing that the anti-Semites did.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.